The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Thanks for being a Mix 92.6 listener and for tuning in today to The Parents Show, whether that's on FM, DAB or online. Welcome to this evening's show. I'm Vivian Glass, and joining me today to talk about the Football Association's Respect Code is Steve Maker, the Hertfordshire Football Association's Head of Football and Investment. Welcome, Steve, to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Great to be here.
Thank you for joining us, Steve. Now, I mentioned specifically something here around the Football Association's Respect Code. Would you mind just telling us a little bit about what it is, its concept and its aims?
Sure. It's come about to try and support clubs and grassroots football to recognise the role it plays in setting positive environments and experiences for participants within the game. And it provides a bit of a toolkit for our clubs and our networks to work towards and offer advice and guidance for them.
So what are the sort of issues that you're hoping to address?
I think some of the challenges are well known in the sense of behaviour of mainly adults within our society that come to watch either their children play or their family members play. It's a very small minority of people, I must say, amongst the game. But I think it enables our clubs to have some mechanisms and some toolkits that they can then address those challenges that they're facing and also have some confidence around the things they can do to address those challenges that they might face as a club, because ultimately they don't want to have that reputation or that behaviour associated with them as clubs as well.
Is this nationwide, Steve, or is this very unique to Hertfordshire?
It's a nationwide programme. It's a nationwide programme available to every grassroots club in the country. And it's something that, as a county FA, we fully support to enable our clubs to have the best possible chance of creating that really positive environment for their participants.
So, Steve, if I'm correct, I mean, I've been to a few football matches where the sideline coaching can be quite animated, to say the least. Is that one of the areas? Is it when it sometimes maybe just tips into the wrong side of enthusiasm? Is that something that you're looking to address?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's lots of different programs and support mechanisms out there for our clubs, our coaches, our volunteers. And it's important to recognise that a lot of the people involved are volunteers. So they are doing this for the benefit of the people that they're supporting. And yeah, one of those challenges can be over-enthusiasm on the touchline if they're coaches. And there's lots of now support mechanisms in place, whether that be through support from their club or support from us as a county FA directly, or some training events that coaches can now attend to help them recognise their behaviours and the ways that they might be able to have a more positive experience on their players and the people that they're supporting.
So is this very sort of pitch specific, or does this spread out into the wider football community?
I would say it goes across the wider football community. I think it's not just a match day experience that this can evolve in. I think it all stems from the experience they gather as participants and clubs and volunteers across the whole remit of from training all the way through to their match day experience as well. And as club committees and as club volunteers as well, they have that opportunity to shape this and work with their county FAs to help produce this as well. So it comes across the whole game and it goes across our non-league system as well, in the sense they have a very similar program that works with their spectators and encouraging positive behaviour from spectators in non-league football as well.
So you mentioned the sort of grassroots element there. How significant is this to that particular area of the game?
I would say it's having a positive impact to date. It's our first season as a pilot in many respects to try and really tackle the challenges that are being faced. And I know this isn't just within football as well. This is in other sports. It's very much a challenge that many sports are now facing when adults are watching their young children or young people play football or whatever sport it be. And I think it's it's starting to have an impact, and it's certainly starting to have a positive impact in the way that our clubs are able to then look at what they can do to support the experience that their participants are having, because that's ultimately what they're there to provide, a really positive, nice, enjoyable experience for the people that are involved. We have a lot of research and data that tells us that the majority of young people that play football are doing so because they want to be with their friends. They want to have a positive experience. They want to learn how to play the game. They want to have a fun game, in the sense that it's a fairly even and competitive game. Young people tell us this, that when it's too one-sided, they don't enjoy it as much. So actually, if we can add this to the toolkit for our clubs to say, these are the things that young people are enjoying and saying that they love about our sport, and we can encourage the adults involved in that to do so and bring that to life as well, that can only help their enjoyment and their sustained participation in the sport. That has huge benefits, not just to football, but to society in terms of long-term health benefits and the behaviours that creates for our young people participating in the game later on in life.
I mean, I know from my experience, seeing younger children particularly, you know, they can have a really overdeveloped, perhaps you might say, but a very well-developed sense of justice. And when they perceive things as unfair, or when they may actually be unfair and they see someone, you know, fouling or something like that, that they really object to, that can be very off-putting, I think, for some of the younger players. Is that something that you see played out in some of the clubs that you're working with?
Absolutely. I think it's really important that we recognise as the role of adults within all of this. We are the adults within all of this. And it's really important that adults recognise that ultimately we are there to support those young people when they're having those moments of concern or challenge or upset. And often it's our role to appease them and support them, not set examples where they will then escalate that even further. And I think it's a really important mechanism for the adults involved within the sport, be that parents observing and watching the game, or the coaches on the sideline, or even the match officials in the middle of the game, if they're lucky enough to have a match official in the middle of the game, to just really appease those individuals and start to help them understand what it is, because that's a life skill. That's something that they need to understand and learn, that actually not everything will go your way in life. And sometimes you need to recognize that and just have a coping mechanism to help you understand that you might not perceive it as fair, but there are rules here and we have to abide by those rules. And sometimes those things are areas that as adults we have to support those young people with.
And I've seen, you know, parents on the sideline watching their child, and then the child comes off of the pitch, and rather than maybe noticing some of the good things that went well in the game, the focus can be very much on the negatives and on where the parent perhaps perceived that there was a missed opportunity or something that should have been done differently. Is that also part of this respect code? Is there a bit of guidance there around parental support, I suppose?
Absolutely, in the sense of enabling parents to support their young people in a positive way. And I say that in the sense of the role of a parent in that environment is really, really important in my view. They can be the tipping point sometimes in the enjoyment of their child. And it is really important from my perspective that they understand the role they play within their child's enjoyment in this sport. We have a lot of recommendations out there for clubs in terms of code of conducts for parents and spectators. We have clubs that have really good philosophies and ways of identifying what they stand for as a club, and encourage the parents to get on board with that and look at the ways that they can support that. But ultimately, I'm a grassroots volunteer myself, I coach grassroots teams, and I always say to the parents involved in the groups I work with that I want them to do three things. I want them to enjoy watching their children play, I want them to support them and encourage them throughout, and I want them to celebrate everything they do that's great. And if they can do those three things, that will help us as a coaching team and the club to help create a really positive environment for those young people.
Something I've become aware of as a parent of a sporting child is that it's quite important sometimes for me to zip it, for me to put my, you know, my perception of what happened, what went well and what didn't to one side and make space for my child to give their perception, first of all, of what went well. And sometimes the two things are very different. And what I'll have been watching on the one hand, you know, thinking that they were doing very well, you know, the perception will be completely different on the ground and on what's actually happening and what's in their head, or vice versa. They might see a win on something that I might not have picked up on. It might be a small thing. It might be a little bit of extra speed or a little bit of, you know, a little bit more courage in tackling or whatever the situation is. So, you know, that's something just as a parent I've witnessed for myself. But how are you delivering this code? How does that embed itself in our local clubs?
It's a really good question. It's something that is shared and adopted by clubs and counties. It is something that the clubs are able to come back to their county FAs for support on. And it's very much a club-driven mechanism, I suppose, and program that can be delivered, but with the support from the county FA. So we, as a county FA, we can support them and look at ways that we can encourage them to work with their volunteer groups, their parents and everybody else involved in their club to take on board these messages and adopt these messages. And I think your point earlier around the space between allowing your child to have a conversation and recognize what there is, it's really encouraging that connection between the parents and the coaches to understand what those wins are, because the coaches will be working with your children and suggesting that there's things that they're asking them to do on the pitch and what does success look like for them on the pitch beyond the result. So there will be things that the coaches are working with that your team and your children on that will encourage them to develop and get those small wins that help them develop and progress and become better football players and potentially better people as well through it. So I think it's really important for the two to connect and have those conversations, and also enable those children to recognize the great things they're doing throughout that process and what they're doing. And if there's that space for that conversation to happen, even better. I know of some coaches that will encourage parents to ask certain questions after the game in the car ride home or the walk home or whatever it be, that enable that space to happen where they're saying, how did the game go today? What did you like about it? What was something you did really well within the game type questions?
Oh, the car ride home. That's the moment, isn't it? That's the moment, yeah. Whether they're going to be singing and, you know, celebrating in the back seat, or whether you've got sullenness and tears, or, you know, tears of frustration, whatever, you just never know how it's going to go, do you? How are you sort of seeing this played out with the feedback that you're receiving? What's the sort of response to this so far?
As I say, I think it's had a positive impact to date. It's very early in the life of the strategy for us with this piece of work, and we're still in our first season with it and all the pieces of the jigsaw, if you like, that go with it. There's the silent support weekend that attaches alongside this that enables young people to play in a environment without all the noise from all the adults around them and everything else that goes with it, and enables them to make those decisions for themselves and understand the way that they can play the game in their own terms. There's elements of behaviour improvement that goes on across the game now as well for our more serious cases. And the code is part of that package. And the grassroots code is something that enables our clubs to have that guidance to everyone involved within their club and enables them to fall back on that if anyone doesn't adhere to it, so that they can say, this is everything that the club signed up to. This is, as members of our club, this is what you've signed up to. And we've certainly seen some really positive examples of changes in those behaviours within clubs that they've reported back to us. It's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. There's going to be some challenges along the way. It's the first season, but we are starting to see some slow, gradual improvements within those environments within the clubs.
And we've mentioned about, you know, the sort of parental support, or sometimes perhaps a mislead support. But what about when you're taking a child, for instance, to a match? Sometimes, I'm from Scotland, as you can hear from the accent, some of the games that took place in Glasgow, there was no way you would set foot outside, or I wouldn't on match days after sort of 7 p.m. because things just got crazy. And near the football grounds, you know, sometimes it was terrifying, even as an adult. It's put me off. I'm very hesitant to take my child to a football game and to expose them to perhaps abusive language or, you know, negative behaviours that that may have been my experience. Is that something that we can feel much more confident with this code in place, that this is going to be a much more enjoyable experience, something that really you can take your family along and feel confident that, you know, everybody's there for the team and to support it in the best possible way?
I certainly hope so. I certainly expect so. And I would encourage parents to ask that question of the clubs that they're taking their children to as well, in the sense of, what is your club philosophy? What can we expect from the volunteers that are coaching the team and the club committee? And what does the club stand for? And does that align to our own values as a family, as adults, as a group of children that want to participate? Clubs will have their own philosophy. Clubs will have their own way of operating and the things they stand for. And I think it's really important to find a club that works for you and your family. There's an England accreditation club program out there. So one of the questions I would be asking if I'm taking my children to a new football club would be, are you an England accredited football club? Because that ensures they meet certain standards and criteria around safeguarding qualifications for their coaches, and the club have certain policies and procedures in place that protect the club and protect the people involved in playing in those clubs. And then I would be asking around, what is that? What does the club stand for? What is the club's philosophy on football? And how do they, not in the sense of how do they want the game played, but in terms of, are they a win at all costs clubs, or are they a club that value equal playing time for every member of the squad? Are they a club who value the environment they create for the young people involved within their clubs? And how do they do that? What does that look like? I would say the same thing applies if you're going to watch a professional club. Is that the right club? Some of our professional clubs, particularly in Hertfordshire, have really nice connected family sections where you can go, and it is families within those sections. And it's a really nice introduction to a game of professional football for you and your children to go and watch. They can't obviously accommodate for the rest of the noise going on around the ground, but within the section that you will sit in will be families, will be young people coming in to watch the game and enjoy that experience together as a group. And sometimes clubs will take the teams there and go as a team to do those sort of things. So, yeah, I think you're certainly seeing a different environment to even a decade ago, when there was a lot of unwanted attention.
Yes. Oh, well, that is really positive news, Steve. And I mean, we talked briefly about, you know, coaches as well, but they have such a huge role to play. You know, they can be such a big inspiration to children who are looking up to them and really, you know, being able to have that relationship of trust and of respect. Who would you say at the moment are the greatest role models for kids in football?
Oh, that's a very good question. I'm looking at the young people I speak to will always look up to the professional footballers and the ones that are very good within the game. But I think you see a lot of the England squad now that have set very good examples as role models within the game. And they do a lot of good outside of their role as a footballer. And those would be the people I would expect and encourage young people to look up to and say it's not just about their wealth or their fame or their stature. Look what they do for their communities, for their club, for their country when they're performing, but also how do they go about their business? I know Marcus Rashford did a lot of work around his community during lockdown, and every club encourages their players to do something for their local community, whether that be supporting food banks, donation of funds or items or charities they support or whatever it be. So there's a lot of good going on within the game, particularly at a professional level and particularly within our England squad. They're trying really to raise the bar in the example they set. to young people. And the same for our women's team as well. They're doing exactly the same thing in the sense of pushing those boundaries, in the sense of getting the awareness of female football out in the game, and creating some really good role models within the female game as well. They have a fantastic group of players there that are involved, and coaching team there. And yeah, those would be the people I'd be looking to and going, what are they doing beyond the sport to benefit their community, to benefit the people that need it most?
And again, you know, the past 10 years ago, you know, I didn't see anything like we see now about women's football. The success has been phenomenal. So I just think that's such a positive development as well in the sport, and things are definitely sounding like, you know, this respect code's taking shape. It's sounding extremely positive and extremely inspirational, really, for young people to still be able to take up the sport and feel included and valued and have a sense of trust around what they're doing too.
Absolutely, yeah.
Steve, I've really enjoyed talking to you for this evening's show. Thank you so much for joining me. If our parents and our listeners want to learn more, is there a website that they can go to? You've mentioned a couple already. Can you give us your best tips for where to go for more information?
Sure, of course. So the work around the grassroots code and behaviour top tips in football can be found at englandfootball.com. And if you wish to gather further local information, you can find Hertfordshire FA on X and LinkedIn through at Hertfordshire FA. And we'll have lots more information on there. You'll find lots of connected dots, and also on Instagram as well.
Brilliant. Steve, you've given us such a lot of food for thought today. I really appreciate you joining us on The Parents Show. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
We'll take a quick break now on The Parents Show on Mix 92.6.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
So welcome back to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. It's great to have you with us again.
I'm Lydia El-Khoury, and I'm delighted to be joined by our regular contributor, presenter, Karen Hannan, here on The Parents Show this evening. Karen, thanks a million for joining us on The Parents Show.
Oh, always a pleasure. Always lovely to spend time with you, Lydia.
You too, Karen. I love chatting to you. I love learning from you every time we have a conversation. You know, you switch lights on in my brain that were never going to be switched on, I think. And in particular, obviously, around special educational needs and our neurodivergent community. So we have had a series of fantastic conversations with you about the elevated risk of young people with neurodivergence when it comes to coercive control. I have to say that was a really interesting conversation. I learned a lot, and I'm sure it's really helpful for parents who are listening in. So we talked about the elevated risk. We definitely talked about the impact of it, and it's something we need to all pay attention to. Now, what we'd like to dial down on is what parents can proactively do about this elevated risk in young people.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a few things they can do. I think the first thing would be to get some good education or you know, do some good learning around whichever kind of neurodivergence the child is their experience of life. And I'll just talk about autism today, but we can think about, you know, you can transfer this kind of thinking across to other neurodivergences as well. And that is that often, and we actually just recently had a conversation about looking at the different models of neurodivergence and why they're important. So I'm going to touch slightly on that right now, and then we're going to go into that in more detail in another session. But we have to, number one, help parents and young people move away from this kind of doom negative narrative around, let's say, autism, for instance. And we have to find ways to help the child and the young person and the family to embrace this identity and to feel positive about it and to see potential and have aspirations for the child, rather than the very negative worries that parents may have and the concerns that children and young people may have about being different, that is more prominent because the dominant model in our society is what is called the medical or deficit model. And the narrative around that is very doom-laden. And it cites very specifically this way of being, let's say, autistic, for instance, as being a negative and as being problematic. And people are, you know, naturally woke to catastrophize about it, either about themselves or their children, because people worry about themselves and they also worry a lot about their children. And so inevitably, it takes on this sort of very negative beast of a, you know, of thinking around it. That really can be a barrier to a child having positive life experiences and life outcomes, and the same for families. And usually it's rooted in a lack of understanding that has been taught to, you know, it's a learned behavior. So what I would say is it's a good idea to, number one, educate yourself about other ways of thinking about autism, right? And also why that's important. And people can tune into the other sessions to understand what they might be, those models that will help. The one I like to focus on is the empowerment and affirmative models. But so it starts with, the difficulty starts with this negative notions around being autistic, for instance. And those negative messages are absorbed by the child subliminally, whether they're direct comments, whether it's the parents' worries. And this is all done unwittingly, often parents, and I was one of those parents, are making mistakes because they just don't understand what the impact is of this kind of level of worry that we might have, okay? So what happens is the child or the young person and the families grow up feeling incredibly isolated, incredibly misunderstood. This way of being, let's say autism, is, you know, is positioned as being incredibly problematic, and therefore that's the narrative and the self-stigma that the child begins to grow up with. So the first thing we can do is educate ourselves about the positives of being neurodivergent, so that we can send those messages to our child. We can help our child begin to understand their strengths. We can help our child understand the richness of the neurodivergent community they belong to. We can help our child recognize the contributions they're going to make positively to society. We can begin to educate ourselves about positive role models for our child. So, for instance, if our child loves a particular sport, let's take swimming. So Michael Phelps, I'm showing my age here. I'm sure there are other swimmers now, but he's an ADHD young man, and his prowess and his success came from the drive that came from being ADHD and the focus, that hyper-focus that comes with it when you are playing to your strengths. So there's something about understanding that our children are different and we as neurodivergent people are different. That doesn't mean we don't have huge value. And we need to send those messages to our children that you are valued, you are lovable, you are worthwhile, you have a right to be proud of yourself, we are proud of you, rather than the sort of worry undertone that sometimes goes with it. So that's what I would say, number one. And I think the other thing is then once you know that, is to move from that knowledge and approach, think about a sort of idea of radical acceptance. So where you accept this child for who they are. And when you get all the naysayers, and sometimes that can come from within your own families, again, because people want the best for the child and they misunderstand how to do that, you're probably going to get an awful lot of advice about maybe what the child should do differently to be less autistic, perhaps in the eyes of others. But actually, all that is saying to the child is there's something, we're not going to accept you as you are. We want you to be a different person. So we have to start with this notion of radical acceptance of who this child is. We have to understand that this child is always, they came out of the womb like this. They're always going to be like this, and they have great value. And we need to focus on, well, how do we help the child create the value and live up to the value and feel and develop self-esteem and self-worth and those senses of self that are so healthy. And that of itself, because we are creating young people who are proud, who have very positive self-image, who, and you know, we're helping them connect with like-minded people through clubs, like if we take Michael Phelps and his swimming, we're reducing the risks. We're reducing the things that make them more at risk of coercive relationships. So I think we start with something like that.
I love the idea of radical acceptance, Karen. And it seems like such a simple idea. And actually, it probably is, but it's a game changer, isn't it? In the kind of life outcomes of a child, just for a parent or a school or a friend to just go, you're grand the way you are. There's nothing wrong with you. You know, it's so affirming and it's so empowering.
You can move even further than that and say, not only are you good as you are, but we need you. The things you can do, the insights you have, the visions that you can have, and that, you know, the fearlessness you might have, and that directness that you have, and all of those things, actually, we need that, because otherwise society stagnates and goes bad. Yeah. Right.
Oh, absolutely. So the kind of the models around diagnosis, it seems to me, are heavily flawed. And we could really do with the direction change in this. Do you see that happening anytime soon, Karen? Is there hope on the horizon that more positive models will be coming in to diagnosis?
Oh, 100%. There is a strong movement towards affirmation or affirmative-based diagnosis, because the process of diagnosis itself, as it currently is, number one, you have to go through mental health services. So that of itself implies there's something wrong with this way of being, whatever the way of being is. And also, it is very clinical, and the language is very negative about deficits, delays, deficiencies, inabilities, treatments, cures, okay. But there is a swing over now, and there's a team of professionals, actually, I think from Ireland started it off, really, it kind of came from, of this affirmative base, where when the diagnostic process is happening and the parent or the person is having those conversations with the person doing the assessment, it's a strengths-based approach. So the reports are written in terms of what the strengths are of this person, what kind of different approaches they may need to remove the barriers they face that are placed in front of them, you know, what creates success for them in communication and around their sensory experience of the world. So it affirms the autistic, let's say autistic way of being. It affirms this with very positive language, and it places the responsibility for success on other people understanding this person's autism, because every diagnosis and report's different. And it places and it gives other people and the person tools to reduce the levels of discrimination and the barriers they face to success, rather than saying this person has needs, which seems to imply that the person is lacking in something, when the reality is it is the environment that is lacking. The environment has created barriers because it suits most people, but it actively works against the autistic, let's say, person. And when we move across to that affirmative model and we say, this is how you say you experience life, we agree this aligns with the notion of being autistic. This is how you've expressed the barriers you face. This is what you have said helps you. These are also our other suggestions about what can help you to have a fairer experience of life and to help you to succeed. And so it gives the person a tool to advocate as well for themselves. So already you're not, you know, if you talk about a person in terms of deficits and impairments and needs, and this notion that there's something wrong with a person, of course, the person's going to grow up with very poor self-esteem, with a very poor sense of self-worth, with very poor self-identity. But if you switch over to a model that is much more affirmative and empowering, and you promote the strengths and you recognize and reward effort and ability for that person, they grow up proud of who they are. They grow up proud of their community. They grow up believing they can achieve. And they don't need the affirmation of other people who might seek to manipulate them. Just because the person has, you know, under the medical model, what happens is you're so desperate to belong, because you feel like you belong nowhere, that you're rife to be manipulated by others that see that vulnerability in you. Whereas if you bring your young person up and you look at that model and you teach them to say no, and by the way, as I've had to learn, that has to apply to the parent too. So I have to be prepared for my child to say no to me and to refuse, because I want them to be able to say no to people that might be trying to get them to do something that's not very good for them. So that's the beauty of those models, those empowerments and affirmative models, is we are skilling our young people with really important risk reductive life skills.
So if a parent's listening in and you're a divergent child, if they haven't been diagnosed, do they have the option to go for a more constructive, positive diagnosis process?
That neuroaffirmative approach, if you like. At the moment, I'm not sure that's the usual model through the NHS at the moment.
Yeah.
So it may be, you know, that it's... But what you can do, there is a book that I can't remember the name of. It's called the Adult Assessment Model, I think. And next time when we speak, you can ask me and I'll tell you. I'll have looked it up, the link for that by then. But it's a handbook for clinicians to begin to understand this affirmative model. So what you can do is just get a copy of the book. There's probably lots of stuff by now on the internet about the affirmative approach to assessment. So you can begin to use that language yourself. And also you can do things like provide your child with really positive role models of their neurodivergence, whatever your child's is. So you might look up really successful autistic people. So let's take Billie Eilish, right? I mean, the autism, the neurodivergent brain and creativity and art, I mean, we are one and the same. Not going to lie, right? We wouldn't have music if we didn't have neurodivergence. We wouldn't have great actors, you know, and also think about those other qualities. You know, if you think about lawyers and you think about litigators, you want someone who can be very direct and not worry too much, you know, that they're getting their point across and they are focused on whatever the outcome is. You know, these are talents that our children have, not things we should worry about. So that's what I would say is you can have a look at that book and we'll as I've said, we'll maybe do it. We'll talk more about it in other sessions.
Great. And anything else parents can do to mitigate the risk of their child or their children's vulnerability being exploited by people who kind of use coercion to control? Yeah.
So what I would say is, like we've just said, you know, if you start from that notion of radical acceptance and you think about, well, what's that structure that you're going to provide for your child or help them to begin to learn to provide for themselves? It's going to provide a structural safety net, if you like. So I know that there is, for children who like gaming, for instance, there is a platform called Spectrum Gaming. You can Google it, run by a young man called Andy Smith. And I believe he started it in the lockdown as a way to, because he'd noticed this risk within, you know, children who were on the internet all the time. Of course, we don't always know who they're speaking to, but this is actually, he runs this platform and young people can sign up and they're with other neurodivergent people. And there are, I don't know what you call it, administrators or whatever, but there's some of oversight within it. So it's a really good thing. And he has loads of resources on his page. So I think if you like gaming, then have a look at that. I think what you can do is notice your child's strengths, like I've said, and you can begin to build up their own self-identity and self-esteem. I think you can find maybe ways for them to connect with other people who have the same interests as them. So if your child is particularly techie, you might enroll them into sort of computing clubs or, you know, that kind of thing. If they like drama and makeup and you know, those sort of creative elements, you might enroll them in a few clubs like that. You know, our older teens, we might help them to learn how to run a small business, you know, that they can maybe sell their stuff on Etsy, right? And the other thing I would say is very often, I think as parents, and I absolutely am guilty of this, and even now, you know, my kids are now 21 almost and 24 nearly, I still veer, as we all do sometimes, towards correction as opposed to connection with my child. And I think particularly as they are moving into the teendom, particularly if it's our first child, so we've not been through that roller coaster already, you know, it's very hard for us as parents sometimes to learn to let go and let them make those mistakes, because we don't want, you know, we want them to be safe and happy, but actually they've got to make mistakes. That's all part of growing up, right? But it's how do we make ourselves available at those times when they really need to come to us because there's something going on that doesn't feel good for them? So it might be just have a regular popcorn night on a Friday night. It might be that, you know, rather that, you know, the word should is an incredibly shaming word, isn't it, Lydia? And I know my reaction when I hear it when someone's talking to me. So I'm not sure why I think my children should respond differently, ironically. But yeah, so I think it's more about maybe using language that notices stuff. So rather than saying, oh, you know, things like, you know, you're in your room all the time, you'll never get off the computer, and you, you know, you don't talk to me. It might be things like, I've noticed you seem much quieter than usual. Is that so? We need to make ourselves available. Obviously, we correct, you know, certain things. So if they do something ridiculous, like pick up the car keys and they don't have a driving license, then we take the keys off them and don't let them get in the car. But I think if it's just that they've got to, you know, they've told you, I was telling someone this the other day. I remember when I worked in hotels years ago, and I remember this time in particular, I went home talking to my dad about this situation, and hotels are crazy places to work, right? I really loved it because no 2 days were the same. And there are lots of funny things that happen, right? So I went home, I was telling my dad all about this thing, and this funny thing happened. And then so I did this. And really what I wanted to do was for him just to enjoy the joke and the lightness of what I was telling him. But what he did was he turned around and told me what I should have done differently, because that would have been better. I would have had, and actually that wasn't the point of what I was saying to him. So this is what I mean. Focus on connection rather than correction.
Yeah, lovely, lovely. That's really constructive, easy advice for us parents to follow. And it really kind of, it will elicit that feeling that we're trying to generate of affirmation and just valuing neurodivergent children for what they are, which is great. Karen, that's brilliant. Really, really helpful. Any last thoughts before we wrap up for today on how to navigate your children and how to help them avoid coercive relationships, apart from building confidence? And you know what? It's beautifully simple. If making them understand that they are valued and loved exactly as they are, and that they have huge value to bring to our world. It's great. I mean, it's so positive and constructive, and it's helpful as well.
Yeah, I think the other thing I would say, I'm a great believer in dropping seeds or asking questions that are clearly not in the mind of the person I'm talking to, but that should be, that they should be asking themselves, but not requiring an answer. So, you know, if I thought, for instance, my child was involved in something that felt like not particularly safe to me, one tack I could have would be to ground them and, you know, not never let them out of my sight and, you know, end up with a child that's running away or, you know, breaking things in my home or whatever. Or I might just say something like, oh, you know, I wonder how easy it would be to remain friends if you weren't doing that stuff with them. Now, commonly what happens is they might want the conversation with that. Actually, they may have been looking for an in for a conversation with me about that, right? So number one, I have to look in their eyes and see, are they engaging with it or not? If they are, then they'll say something and I can continue and maybe help them out. If not, I'm very lucky in that I'm 60 years old. I have a middle, you know, a bladder that needs relieving quite often. So I normally just go, oh, really sorry, I need the loo. And I go to the toilet because I don't need them to have a conversation with me. I just need them to think about that question, right? And at another time, they'll either come to me or they'll suddenly come to me and go, oh, yeah, you know, actually, they were really nasty when I mentioned this about, you know, whatever to them. So all I would say is dropping seeds is fantastic. Don't expect an interaction and provide a way for the interaction to not happen without it feeling weird. And needing the toilet is a really good way to just leave a situation all of a sudden. Because by the time I've come out, they've got bored and wandered off, you know, and we just get on with our day. So,
brilliant. Thanks a million, Karen. Now I'm going to lower the level right down. Are you watching Traitors?
No. Is it good?
Well, no, the reason why I'm asking is because one of the people in the show has autism.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And I'd love your take on it. So that's your task for the next show. You have to watch Traitors and tell me what you think. For me, it's very, very positive because he clearly proudly and rightly so explains that he has autism and he explains how he feels in different situations. I think it's a lovely way because obviously we all know mainstream media is a great way of getting people to put themselves in each other's shoes and it shines a love, you know.
I haven't seen it, but I will have a watch. And I agree. I think representation that people can, where people can connect with a person within that community and see their real life, is always a winner. And in that same token, I've just finished watching the Portrait Artist of the Year. And the winner of that is a young trans man. And that I was, it was, you know, for me, that's about how do people understand the trans lifestyle, the trans way of being, and move away from the terrible rhetorics that sometimes come with people who don't understand, you know, that community. So again, I think anywhere where you can get representation of a minority, particularly a very misunderstood one, that shows the positivity and the value that this community bring to all of us is a win for me. So yeah, I'll have a look. You know, I've avoided it because I just get this feeling there's a lot of tension.
Yeah, I get
and
it.
I can't
there
manage
is
a lot of tension. So I'll do my best.
I have to say I'm the same. I don't like conflict, and that was my concern watching it. But there are some shows that provide good all family viewing, something that we can all sit down and watch together. And there was a consensus to watch Jess, so I kind of I fell in behind. But actually, it isn't giving me that knot in my stomach.
Okay,
that
I'll
I thought
it go, then I'll
like
give it a go and I'll let you know.
Let me know, because I'd like to know what the pros and cons of representation in this case are. But anyway, listen, it's just been so lovely talking to you as always, Karen. Thanks a million for coming on the show.
Oh, it's always a blessing to be here, so thanks very much for having me.
It's all our pleasure. Talk to you soon, Karen.
Bye. Take care.
Bye.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.